You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
A lot of people live in denial because they think that to be realistic is to be depressing.
I'm Dr. Mike, host of Going There.
It was the first song where I wrote about how I felt like my depression was killing me and I didn't want it.
Going There breaks the stigma of mental health issues by having real, honest conversations with your favorite musicians, including Alessia Cara, Lizzie Hale, Jewel, Jason Isbell, Gerard Way, Lauren Gray, Shamir, and Barty Strange.
There was something there that was so raw, where I was like, wow, I can't believe someone would say that.
Let's go there on Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by Sound Mind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network, every other Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everybody, to the Modern Drummer Podcast. Billy Amendola and I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming Chad Cromwell to the show today. Billy, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you? Hey, Chad, how are you?
Hey, buddy, how are you?
I'm good. It was so nice to see you out at Summer NAMM.
Boy, it was, wasn't it? That was a great little story. We literally, the stars lined up on that. Because we would have, in 15 seconds, missed each other, just the way we were traveling through the building that day. I actually had to come back to the booth, which is was just good fortune, because I had already tried to leave once, and had forgotten something, ran back, and there you are.
I know, because the day before I came, you were gone already, because we were trying to get together, and then I said, I'm going one more time, just to see if anybody's around, and I walked in the right door right at the right time.
Absolutely. So
meant to be. So let me give everybody a little bit, you know, I of course, me and you go back, you know, it's probably 20 years or more. And yeah. I first covered you in the March 04 issue of Modern Drummer. And at that time, you were a band member and on tour with Peter Frampton. Let's start right there. Before that, how we had met actually, and how we hooked up, was through our mutual friend Bobby Mayo, who was with Peter Frampton since Frampton Comes Alive, and he was one of the older guys in my neighborhood. I grew up, he grew up in Brooklyn here, so same thing with John, the original drummer with Peter. So he kind of hooked us up. But I had asked him in conversation. I said I heard this song, House. House of Love by Vince Gill and Amy Grant. It was really Amy Grant's song. And I said, my God, who is playing drums? I got to find out who's playing drums on this. And it happened to be you.
Yeah.
So if anyone don't know that song, House of Love, that's what it was called, right?
Yeah, House of Love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Amy Grant and Vince Gill. You have to look up that record because that groove, it is like, that is one of the best grooves I've ever heard. Smooth. Oh, and then from there, he introduced us. And now let's take it into Peter Frampton. How was that whole experience? Because that was a couple of years, right?
Yeah, that was, it was like, I think we worked together on and off. I want to say around 7 years, something like that. What was going on is I was actually jumping back and forth between gigs. At that time, I was obviously working with Peter and Bobby and John Regan for his
bass player. Yeah,
great bass player, a great friend. So we were doing that together, and then I was also helping Mark Knopfler launch his solo career. He had disbanded Dire Straits. And we were in the studio making a record in 95. So 96, we would have begun touring. And so I was bouncing back and forth between sessions and tours with Mark to do sessions and tours with Peter. It just all kind of worked out for a few years there where that was able to happen. It was a good fortune for me to get to be with both of those guys. But So Peter, just, badass quartet. What can you say? You know, it's great music, great playing, wide open sort of playing, tools and clicks to lock to. Just a band up on deck going for it, you know?
I know. I was fortunate enough to see you a couple of times, and that was a great lineup. That was really good. That was a good period of time. Not too many, like you said, you were blessed to have that kind of career because it just happened organically. And not too many people, there's only a few people, Mickey Curry, there's only a few people who were able to play with multiple people live and still keep the whole recording thing happening.
Exactly, yeah.
So
yeah.
That's pretty cool.
I have no idea how we pulled that off because, I'm in Memphis, or sorry, I'm in Nashville. I don't know where I am anymore. I'm in Nashville at our apartment here right now. And then our main home is over in LA. But I was here doing sessions since 1990 in Nashville. And I remember people telling me when I relocated here, I remember them saying to me, look, if you're going to get into the studio scene in Nashville, this touring thing, I don't know that that's going to line up because, they want you there. And if they get wind of the fact that you are on tour, everybody's going to think you're gone forever. You know, it's just this kind of thing that happens, you know. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to take that on board and get myself established in town. Finally did. But I couldn't help it. I couldn't just be a studio rat. Playing live is like a big deal to me, as much a big deal as being a session player, So figuring out how to negotiate both of those things and keep it alive was, and like what you were saying, Mickey has been able to do. Looking back, I really don't know how we've pulled it off because when I started touring with Knopfler, we were on the European continent for 4 months, rehearsing for 2 months. So I was literally gone from Nashville and the United States for 6 months. And when I came off of the tour, I just went right back to studio work. And it was, the clients were still there. They were still willing to hire me and wait around or do whatever. And so it allowed me this extraordinary gift of getting to be both,
Right. But yeah, no, that, that, that's, it just happened the way it was supposed to happen. I love the whole circumstance thing of how one thing leads to another. Yeah. And talking about session work, when you know, you were born in Memphis and then you moved to Nashville in 90?
Yeah, I came in 90, but I was actually, career-wise, I was based out of Memphis, commuting to Los Angeles and to San Francisco because I was real involved. It's the same thing. I was involved in session work in LA. Then I was involved with Neil Young and still am, which took me north. And that was basically going to his ranch. So that was sort of like being sequestered, you know, and doing that kind of thing. So I was running back and forth between LA and San Francisco, living in Memphis.
Wow. And playing with three major stars, Peter Frampton, Mark Knopfler, and Neil Young. And talking about live, I mean, for you, it must have felt great rocking in the free world. Not only did you record that, you played that live with Neil, you're in the video. Yeah. So it's like, that's a song that, like, it feels like this is what I like. I like playing live. I like playing in front of people. And that energy, you know, that energy is there. Let's go back a second now while we're talking about bass players, because we mentioned John Reagan, who is also a mutual friend of ours and everything. You've played Rick Rosa, Michael Rhodes, and then Willie Weeks. So any tips on playing with a bass player? Because you've played with some great, great bass players.
Yeah, man. You know, that's a really good question, and almost nobody ever brings that up. What I do for a living as a drummer is not drummer centric per se. It's rhythm section centric and song centric. And then maybe somewhere a few rungs down the ladder will be, you know, I'm going to play badass Phil right here, you know, be a drummer, you know, but that's not so
if appropriate,
but the thing to your question is, in order to for that to really get traction, then you've got to be working with a bass player that share the same language of music. The more you can align with that, the deeper the pocket's going to get, you know, and the deeper the vocabulary between the players is going to get, you know. So this whole thing just sets roots for brand new songs. Like you brought up House of Love, you know. Well, that's an example. That was Tommy Sims on bass on that.
Right.
And so, you know, and actually I think that was the first session I had ever done with Tommy. And it was boom. It was like, okay, no need to discuss what's going to happen. We're feeling this the same way. So guys, like you mentioned, like, you know, with Michael and Willie and Rick, you know, rest in peace, my brother. You know, those guys just, I had that language with, and it was just, it never seemed like work because we just interpreted the groove and the direction of the song from the foundation. We just felt it the same way.
So I know that's a great thing too, because you, as we know, playing with a great bass player just makes you automatically play better and not think, and then that magic happens. Absolutely. Because a lot of times the drummer gets the blame. If it's not grooving, you know, we get the blame. You know, it's like, well, you're not, it's not grooving. But yeah, neither is the rhythm guitar, neither is the bass. It's like, come on. So
yeah, man. Yeah. So, well, you know the old saying, you know, the drummer might get the blame, but he is gonna get the girl.
This is true.
Yeah. You know it's true.
And my love to Wendy. I love Wendy.
Thanks. She said to me last night, because she knew I was going to talk to you, you know, she said, be sure to get a lot of pictures. And I went, pictures of what? How do I do this? Before we all hang up, I'm going to do this. I'm just going to get a quick still shot of the screen, if you guys don't mind, and I'm going to send it over to her.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. And Wendy, by the way, just to give a shout out to Wendy, she has her own career singing background with, I mean, besides Ringo, I mean, so many people. And then now let's go into Joe Walsh, because the last thing you did that I saw you and Uncle Joe, I call Uncle Joe, he's like my Uncle Joe Vitale, and Wendy singing background, and that's a great band.
Yeah, that's a great band.
Let's talk a little bit about, now you've had a long career with Joe Walsh as well.
Yeah. Well, I go back to 86 with Joe, and probably most notable as far as recording goes, we did a record together called Ordinary Average Guy. That was actually a really big hit for him. Mm-hmm. And that was very early on in my working with Joe, who I met in Memphis at the time. That's how we connected. And playing with Joe is like, my first way of working with Joe was as a trio. It was just me and Rick and Joe. And it was just, you know, I got a real education in what electric guitar, the rhythm, how important rhythm is to solos. And Joe, like, really, really just taught me so much about that, and about groove and pocket and all that, and soloing all at the same time, which is a huge load to carry for him. But man, there's not anybody better at doing trio rock and roll guitar playing than that guy.
Yeah, that goes back to James. How was it
compared to Frampton? Like, when you look at playing behind these two legendary guitarists, and they're both grooves.
Yeah, very, very similar. You know, in the compositional aspects of the way they play, you know, it's like, you know, when you listen to Peter play, he's incredibly melodic in his solos. And, but the thing that's so, it's compositional. So it's like he's playing a solo that might be 5 minutes long. But so how is it that after we hear Peter do a song with this super, super long solo, why is it that we can remember the contents of that solo and then we can listen to some other virtuoso chop monster, you know, gazillion notes kind of thing? We can listen to those guys. I can't remember a damn thing they play, you know? I mean, it's like mind-bogglingly technical and impressive, but from a song point of view and a hook,
it's not melodic. Those other guys, what Joe and Peter are playing are melodies and musical passages that happen to be part of their solo, which is what makes you remember it. Right. And as a drummer behind that, what you're locking in with the bass player, you know, how do you support them so that all of this sounds so great? Because what a lot of people don't realize is that what makes the guitar solo as great as it is, mm-hmm. is the fusion of all of the band members playing together. And it's what you don't play and how you do play the things that you're executing that bring it all together and make it sound awesome as opposed to just good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, what it feels like from my point of view as a drummer that's playing for, you know, let's just say, we'll say Joe, you know, I remember how I felt when I heard the first 4 or 5 notes and I already knew what the song was, you know, of the intro of Funk 49. And so what that feels like is like, I'm getting ready to play this song with this guy, you know? And you know, with Peter, it's, do you feel that same feeling of like, oh, this is, I can't believe I'm here. I'm actually like playing these iconic songs with these amazing artists. And it's computing with me as a young player that this is all about songs, guys. This is mostly about that, you know? And then the playing, the brilliant playing that gets to go with it is the icing on the cake. And so from a drummer's point of view, it justifies every risk I ever took to get to do this for a living, you know? And there aren't that many of those guys out there and gals that there just aren't that many out there that are that impressionistic on a whole culture, you know,
and have that long span of a career. Yeah. Yeah. You know, they're not a flash in the pan. I mean, God, yeah. They're still relevant just as much today as they were then.
Absolutely. And you know, they literally are. The records keep coming, you know, the touring keeps going. I mean, Joe's out, you know, killing it with the Eagles right now still. And Peter's recording a couple of miles from here, you know, because he's just a pure musician and it's sort of a never ending process. Neil is the same way. Just incredibly prolific and almost like, all these guys, they have this kind of childlike energy for doing it. And it's like, it's almost like nobody can help it. It doesn't matter. Well, I had the hit record that posted, you know, chart position 3, that's for 16. You know, there are guys out there that are just obsessed with success. And then there are other guys that are obsessed with what am I writing next? You know, when is the muse coming for the song? When do I get to be in the studio with my band again? All that stuff, you know, is like, it doesn't matter what the hits were. What matters is where we're headed. You know, like what's the forward momentum of
right. And no resting on your laurels. They still right. move forward and they're breaking new ground.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Dad, when I look at your resume of the artists with whom you've played, This podcast could literally be 10 hours long, and I'm not saying that to be funny or stroke your ego or anything of the sort. I'm saying it because I really want all the listeners out there to Google to your work and really understand the breadth of it. So I'm just going to take some of the highlights, and I'd love your input. Like, you've played a lot with Lady A, right? Formerly yeah. known as Lady mm-hmm. Antebellum, and right. you know, massive stars. Tell us about that.
Well, it was the beginnings of it for me were through their producer named Paul Worley, and Paul is a good friend of mine here in Nashville, and an iconic Hall of Fame producer. Session guitarist, he's just incredible. If you want to look somebody up and get your mind blown, that's a guy you want to look up as it's to do with music in Nashville. I don't want to go too far into it, but I'll tell you this: he's produced. Now I'm not talking about albums; I'm talking about singles. He's produced 42 number ones in out of country music. That's got nothing to do with the record sales or the record, all of that. So Paul Worley, that's how I got invited into Lady Antebellum's or Lady A's world. You know, they were just getting started. Paul signed them and wanted to work with them, produce them. And they got just into the beginnings of the first record. And then Paul brought me in to play on, I don't know exactly how many tracks it was. It turned out to be quite a few on the first record. And then we just ran together all the way up through through the one with Need You Now on it. And, you know, their biggest, those big, big hits.
Through yeah, that. Although they had a good, it's almost like a greatest hits album, that one album.
Oh, yeah, no, it's ridiculous. Yeah, it's just one hit after another. And so that's how I met them. And, you know, they're just, they're incredible talents, all three of them. And, you know, their track record speaks for itself, obviously. But great, really great band.
And now going back, a lot of people may not know that you played on Leanne Rimes' debut album.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't even know. I was playing. Anyway, that's a long story, but
yeah, she was a kid.
Oh yeah, little bitty thing, and we got brought in to play on her music, and you know, I remember as I recall, this is a long time ago, Billy, but as I recall, we overdubbed on some tracks that she had already sung on, right? So I didn't meet her at the very beginning there. I played on that stuff, but we weren't in the room at the same time together. But I remember when we started playing on the songs, put the cans on, start playing, and here's this voice, you know, and I'm thinking, who is this? You know, and they told me who it was, and you know, in one ear, out the other, next session, see you later, bye. Didn't think a thing of it. And as it turned out, it was, you know, it was a huge record for her.
Iconic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've played, and Chad, you've played a lot with Amy Grant. That's been another mainstay of yours. What are some of the hits you played on and what with Amy and how, and tell us like your approach to Amy, you know, her music. Cause you know, most drummers don't have the kind of staying power that your discography has, you know, where it's not just a one and done thing. And there's nothing wrong with one and done, by the way, because that's how we all make a living, is playing on records and as many as we can. But in your case, it's gone much further than that, because that you're on the next one and the next one and the next one. So you're obviously approaching it so spot on that it's working perfectly for the artist. And I want the listeners out there to try to understand how they can apply that to their playing. So let's use Amy Grant, if that's cool with you, as like a case study that, since you have a big discography with her. Never, never, never gonna fall. Well, I bet you.
Funny, you think.
is funny.
That's a good one because, you know, Amy's a pure songwriter, and I'm going to use House of Love as the template for what your question is, because, you know, a lot of things kind of merged with her as a writer and as an artist and as a singer, you know, kind of interpreting music the way she does it. And, her producer on that project, Keith Thomas. Sorry, Keith, I was spaced out there for a minute. Keith was her producer at the time, and Keith is like a virtuoso musician, producer.
Legend, really.
He's just produced tons and tons of pop hits, you know? And we're on this song. And by the way, that song House of Love is written by Wally Wilson and Kenny Greenberg, who are both really, really close friends of mine, particularly Kenny. Kenny and I are like brothers. And so they wrote that song. So we're there, to do this track. Well, the demo of the song was, I had actually played on the demo as well. And the demo was just pretty much a straight up R&B kind of a groove, you know, and very much a Memphis influenced thing, or you could say some Muscle Shoals in there, or, you know, just kind of a definitely R&B. And so she loved the song. And the song kind of called to her, in a way that she really connected with. Then Keith, with all of his pop influences, you know, took that R&B groove that song had, and then he elevated it into more of a pop music approach rather than us just staying really pure and true to just R&B, right? So this kind of intersection happened, and Amy, because she's such a great natural musician, she understood how all of that was merging in just the right way at just the right time in her career. And bang, you know, hit record.
Yeah, you brought that Memphis sound. I mean, that groove hit me so hard. And, you know, and we didn't know each other at that time, so I didn't know, you know, if you were an R&B drummer, if you, you know, I knew you were in Nashville, a country drummer. So it is, I mean, you know, it's Roger Hawkins. It's like, yeah, Al Jackson. It's like, yeah, you brought that feel right to that record. And I think that's what made her even sing it even the way she did. And, you know, it added. Now, talking about producers, you've worked with amazing producers. Dave Stewart of the Eurythmics, obviously.
Yeah.
And you did a record, Josh Stone record. I think that might have been her last record, because now she had a baby and she's doing really well, relaxing. But you did that Josh Stone record, and I remember the sound quality of that record. I don't, was that recorded differently or the sound quality of that record was incredible.
Josh's record, you mean?
Yeah, with Dave.
We tracked it at Blackbird, and
in Nashville.
Yeah, in Nashville, here in Nashville. And there was a particular happy accident that happened on the first sessions that I did with Dave, that ultimately became this band that we kind of have together with Dave now, recording band. Dave wanted to be in the room with us. And so the kit was out in the main room, you know, the ambient, you know, big space, you know. And Dave wanted to be in kind of in the room with where we were all sitting. So they set up SM7, which is, for those of you who don't know what that is, that's a microphone, a specific type of condenser mic that's made to manage a lot of external sound in a way that allows someone to sing or speak into the microphone without too much bleed onto everything. So it was kind of a risky thing to do, because whenever you put a microphone in a room where the drums are.
So you were cutting the rhythm tracks together?
Yeah,
live.
Yeah, we were doing rhythm tracks. And anyway, there was a sound that actually came from the fact that his little vocal mic, scratch mic, was set up so that he could talk and sing and do whatever while we're figuring out arrangements. Well, if you muted that microphone, it messed up the whole drum sound, you know? And so if you took the mute off of the mic, there it is. It's that huge kick-ass thing going on, you know? So that mic, whenever we're in the studio together, that SM7 goes up. Dave's usually not there on that mic anymore, but the happy accident created a sound that then carried over into Joss's project, right? Because it's really a pretty specific group of guys that record those records when Dave's producing them.
Right.
So that's how those records sound the way they do. If you listen to Blackbird Diaries of Dave's, which was the first record we did together, you'll hear what I'm talking about. If you compare that with Joss's record. And then we just made another one last fall.
Wow. And then was this before or after Stevie Nicks? Because a lot of people don't realize that they produced a Stevie Nicks record in Nashville with you guys.
Joss was before Stevie. Yeah.
And same technique with the mic he used?
Pretty much.
Chad, was the SM7 stereo or one mono SM7?
Just mono.
Yeah. Okay, gotcha.
I mean, you know, the ironic thing about all this is that, you know, John McBride, the engineer that works with Dave, is also the owner of Blackbird Studio. And he's got, without question, the best microphone collection in the world. And so he's got these mics all over my kit. There's probably a quarter of $1 million worth of microphones sitting on my kit, but then they set up a $375 microphone for the scratch vocal that ended up turning out to be a huge influence on the overall drum sound, you know? So it's just funny how mysterious sonics can really do some funny stuff in a studio, and you never know from where it's going to come. And it's not always the most expensive microphone.
And it's always a happy mistake, which is great.
Yeah, it makes it fun.
Yeah. All right. There's two things I want to cover real quickly before we go.
Right.
One, playing with Paul McCartney. When Paul McCartney, because a lot of people don't know that backstory. I'll try to make it real quick. The backstory was Mark Knopfler wanted to do Neil Young wanted to do A Day in the Life. You guys were learning it and wind up doing it. And then Sir Paul McCartney comes out at Hyde Park and sits in with you guys. How was that?
Well, what you just said, you encapsulated what was over 2 years of time that transpired, right? From the time that he called me into his room in Florence. I'll never forget this because it just came so far out of left field, you know, but we were, I was just coming into that tour with him, and we were doing production rehearsals in Florence where the summer leg of that particular tour in 08 started. And so we were camped out at this hotel in Florence and working and rehearsing and blah, 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 getting ready. And one afternoon he just called me. He says, "Can you come to the room for a minute?" I went, "Sure." And what, you know, and whenever that happens, you're not sure. You're really not sure what's getting ready to happen.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went up there and I said, and he goes, "Man, check this out." He goes, "Listen to this, you know." So he puts on "Day in the Life," you know, and we're sitting there listening to it, and I'm going, "Okay, I'm here with Neil. Why are we listening to the Beatles? You know, is he lonely? What's going on here? You know, got a memory? I don't know." And it just seemed odd, a bit odd. And so the day in the life finishes and he goes, do you think we could do this song? You know, and I said, well, I said, by virtue of the fact that you would even ask me that question says we have to do this song. We got to do this. And he goes, all right, then we're going to start rehearsing. We're going to start rehearsing this thing. And so little bit by little bit, everybody was learning their parts. And it was so cool to watch Neil work those guitar parts out, because that's not simple to play that and sing it. You know, it might sound that way, but it's not that simple, and to do it correctly, you know. And so Neil's not used to working up other people's music at all, you know. And so we're working away at this thing, and we would literally work on like an 8-bar section each day, you know, very slow learning process. I'm used to, in what I do for a living, I'm used to doing that in 30 minutes. But it's just this is very much a band scenario and working it up real organically and slowly. So we just kept getting better and better and better at it in sound checks. And finally he just said, let's do this thing. Let's do it. You know, so I don't remember what city we were in the first time we did it, but I do remember we're going to be doing this song a lot, because people were absolutely losing their minds at the arrangement that we did of it. And so fast forward from the summer of 08 to the end of the summer in 09, we were, our last show was at Hyde Park Calling Festival in London. And we're playing and it's our last night, and there's going to big dinner thing after the gig, and everybody says goodbye, you know, just end of tour stuff.
Yep.
Party is going to happen. And so we're all thinking, everybody's like, we're going home, we're going home, we're going home. And we get to the end of the show, and really the show was almost like a blur to me, because we had just done the night before, we did Glastonbury Festival. So Hyde Park looked like a club gig compared to Glastonbury. So it was just kind of, you know, we were just kind of winding it down. That's not that we weren't rocking, but it was just that, you know. And we get to the end of the show, you know, we finish the set with Rockin' in the Free World, and there's cheering and everything for Neil to come back out. And I could see my drum tech told me, he ran up to me and right before we started Rockin' in the Free World, he ran to me, he said, Paul's here. And I said, what? What? He goes, McCartney is here. He's here with his fiance. They're over at the monitor console. I went, holy shit. So we play Rockin' in the Free World, and I excitedly run off the stage with everybody else to get ready for the encore. And I run up to Elliot, Neil's manager, who's standing there, and I said, McCartney's here. And he went, what? And I said, Paul McCartney's here. You know, he's here. You know, and I knew we were getting ready to do Day in the Life. And he goes, I don't give a fuck who's here. This is the Neil Young concert. And we're going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I said, Elliot, you got to tell Neil before we go back out there. He has to know, man. He's not going to be happy if he finds out after the fact that he's there. So, you know, he kind of begrudgingly, right before we went on, he just sort of ran up to Neil, whisper his ear. Next thing I knew, I saw Neil shoot across the stage, back in front of the crowd. They go nuts. And he went straight over to Paul. They hugged. And I went, great, at least that happened. And now we're going to play this song for Paul. We get up there and we play this tune, and it's rocking. It's all doing what it's supposed to do. And then we get to the middle 8 section of Day in the Life. That's the part Paul wrote. Okay.
I woke up.
Huh? Out of bed. That's the part that Paul wrote. Lennon wrote everything else. Yep. Unless somebody can tell me otherwise, I know that's the way it went. Here comes Paul. And he just walks out on stage, you know.
That's amazing.
All this is on YouTube if you guys want to look it up, if you haven't seen it. It's on YouTube. He comes out, and then it's just all hell breaks loose from there on, man. And it's just, it was obviously way near the top of the musical moments.
What a way to end the tour too. That put the cherry right on.
Yeah, there. Man, it was unbelievable. Yeah.
One last thing now, let's talk gear.
Yeah, so, man.
I want to thank you for supporting Modern Drummer. That, you know, all the years that you've supported Modern Drummer as both a player and now with Craviato. The kit that I saw, let's talk a little bit about that Diamond series and some of the Craviato. Let's briefly get into it.
Okay. All right. Well, so I'm assuming that most everybody in the drummer world knows about Craviato drums now and Johnny's legacy that he left behind with that, just that amazing craftsmanship, you know, and artisan work that he's done or did do. And on Johnny's passing, there was an evolution of time, and I'll keep this short. But there was a bit of a question for a while as to how the company would go forward without Johnny, being as small a company as it was, as artisan based as it was. It was just hard to imagine what that company could look like without Johnny. And so fast forward, things happened, and remarkable things happened. And one of which was the operation in its entirety was relocated from Watsonville, California here to Nashville. And so the factory, all the gear, the tools, the everything is done in Nashville now. And Sam Bacco is heading up the production of Craviato drums now, and is the one and I think only guy that could inherit a task like that, maintain the quality that Johnny put into those solid shells, and then take other visions beyond that into the plied shell world where most of us have to live, you know? And so Sam developed a kit called the Diamond Series. And I gotta tell you, it's one of the most remarkable drum sets I've ever played. We recorded content yesterday. I used that kit. I specifically requested that kit. We're doing a big thing for the F1 racing team that are in town for some kind of Grand Prix that's happening here. And so the team is here. They're coming to the studio, blah, blah, blah. And I wanted the Diamonds to be on that session, which I recorded the track for yesterday. And they're just super badass drums. And they're brilliantly made. The thought that's gone into these shells spans a lot of time and experimentation on Sam's part to get everything where it is. And that's to do with the edges. That's to do with the interior treatment. It's everything. And
the kit that I saw, that me and you took the photo with, that was just a display kit to show all the different colors, right?
Yeah, that's right. But you know what's really funny is that was one of the big hits of the whole show. You know, if you weren't a drummer, I saw people coming over to take pictures of the drums or with the drums because if anybody's seen the kit like that in a while, you know?
It's eye candy. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it absolutely
That's why I said to you, I know you said it's hard to make kits like that because that wasn't the intent. But then I said to you, maybe you should think about like making just a few and renting them out for videos. And because visual-wise, they're gorgeous.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, they sound amazing too. So that's, you know, that always helps.
They really sound great and they look great. And, there's a little bit of a tip of the hat to the traditional look of 60s era drums, you know, early
70s. Right.
There's a little bit of that thing going on, but there's also a modern aspect to the kit, you know, and sonically, without question, I would encourage all the drummers to get out and check these drums out, mainly because the working guys, they've got to have a kit that's stable, that's tuning friendly in all the ranges, you know, high, mid, low. I've never heard any kit do that better, you know. Go, and I prefer, like, typically, I like much lower tunings, almost to the point of bow, you know, like.
Yeah, that really thud, like that 70s thud kind of.
Yeah, I kind of like that, you know. And so I'll tune for that on some of my kits and go for that very specific thing. These drums do it, and they're just everybody that has sat behind the kits so far have either just freaked out or bought them or ordered them or wanted to endorse a company or whatever. There's just a serious buzz. So that and the solid shell stuff that continues, that those drums haven't ever been as in demand as they are right now. It's just amazing what's going on. So
that's great. Yeah, yeah. God bless Johnny. And you know, Johnny, of course, all those years, he learned from the best with John Good and Don Lombardi, you know. So yeah. God bless you, Johnny, wherever you are. And right, hopefully his legacy will continue.
And thank Steve Maxwell, don't forget. Because Steve Maxwell, yeah, you know what, David, brought it back to life.
That's very good point, and very yes, important David. Point. Is Steve is the captain. Steve is the guy that really stayed in there in the trench to get all of the things that I was talking about with the legacy of the company to fruition and where it is now. That's largely Steve's baby that made that happen. And we all know, any of us who know anything about drums and vintage drums and retail are going to know about Steve and his shops. And yeah, man.
Oh yeah,
Steve.
We love you, Steve.
We got a beautiful thing going on with these drums, and we've got price points for the younger cats that are more budget minded. That's a lot of what the diamond stuff is about as well. It doesn't sound like a less expensive kit than the solid kit. It's just a different thing and a really great place to start. So, yeah. Beautiful. Well, Billy, when do I order your kit? You decide what you want, and we'll figure it out, right?
Yeah, we got to get one over for a review.
Yeah, we got to work on that.
Well, listen, thank you so much for taking this time. I know you've been busy this week. We rescheduled a couple of times. Actually, Sarah Hagen sends her love. She was gonna pop in and join us, but she's filming today herself, so she couldn't. When we made the change at the last minute, she couldn't do it, but she sends everyone out there her love. And you can check out her podcast. She does a podcast as well. We all love Sarah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So,
thank you, David. Thank you, Chad. Everybody.
Thank you, Chad.
Yeah, man. Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to meet you in person. I look forward to a dinner sometime somewhere.
It's going to happen. You can count on it. And continued success, and stay safe and healthy.
Thank you, and you as well.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.